Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Kimberly Izar speaks with Congressmember Josh Riley, who represents New York's 19th Congressional District, about the most pressing issues facing the region, from a proposed utility-scale solar project in Sullivan County to the latest news about the closure of the care center at Sunset Lake. Big changes could be coming to the Catskills. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro signed an executive order requiring data centers to meet his regulatory standards. Residents opposing data centers in Northeast PA are skeptical. We talk with the environmental reporter from our partner station WVIA, Kat Bolas. Plus, the latest news from the Lackawack Sanctuary, and it is Black Business Month. We speak with Kendra Payne at Herbal Scoop after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Stocks opened lower this morning after retail giant Walmart reported a slowdown in sales growth. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow fell about 360 points in early trading.
Walmart reported stronger than expected profits for the most recent quarter, but investors were disappointed by slower growth at the discount retailer's existing stores. Sales at those stores rose just 2.6%, which was the smallest increase in nearly 6 years. Walmart sales are closely watched as an indicator of how U.S. shoppers are behaving. Retail gasoline prices are climbing. AAA says the average price of regular gas jumped 2 cents a gallon overnight to about $4.10. Investors who buy government bonds are demanding higher interest rates, which is raising the cost of both public and private borrowing. The federal debt reached a record high this week, topping $40 trillion. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
NPR has learned an unusual Census Bureau report that President Trump says shows widespread illegal voting by non-U.S. citizens has ties to a Trump-aligned think tank. NPR's Hansi Lawang reports data and election experts say that report's conclusions are questionable.
In a social media post, President Trump claimed the Census Bureau's initial analysis of more than 128 million voter records from 2020, quote, proves that over 24,000 non-citizens voted illegally, unquote. Trump said the final number will, quote, explode after the Bureau checks more records. Many past studies and audits, however, show illegal voting by non-U.S. citizens is incredibly rare. The Census Bureau's report lists no authors and gives little explanation about how it analyzed records. NPR has learned the analysis was not done by career civil servants, and the team behind it included individuals affiliated with America First Policy Institute, a think tank started by officials from Trump's first administration. That's according to a Bureau employee who NPR agreed not to name because they fear retaliation at work. Spokespeople for the Bureau and the think tank did not respond to requests for comment. Hansi Lawang, NPR News.
There have been more than 50 heat wave days recorded in France this year, an all-time record. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports the five back-to-back heat waves that started in the spring lasted 52 days.
The previous standout year, 2022, saw three separate heat waves, but their combined duration was 20 days shorter than this year's total. Additionally, the last heat wave that began July 23rd and just ended is the longest single one on record, beating the previous record-holding scorcher from 1983. Two-thirds of Europeans were affected by extreme heat this summer, with heat records broken in France, Italy, Spain, and Great Britain. French health authorities say the sweltering conditions this summer caused more than 7,300 excess deaths. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 335 points. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Israel's military says it's conducting a criminal investigation into troop conduct in Gaza, focusing on the killing of 5-year-old Hind Rajab and her family and the Palestinian paramedics team that tried to rescue her. The child was trapped in a vehicle with her slain family, pleading on the phone for help before she was killed in 2024. But Israel says it won't probe three other attacks that killed aid workers from the World Central Kitchen and from Doctors Without Borders. Chef Jose Andres, founder of the U.S.-based World Central Kitchen, condemned that decision. The judge who oversaw the conviction of a black teenager in the fatal stabbing of a white teenager has been removed from further proceedings in the case. Caroline Love from member station KERA reports it comes as attorneys for Carmelo Anthony appeal his conviction.
Carmelo Anthony, now 19, was convicted for the 2025 stabbing of 17-year-old Austin Metcalf at a high school track meet near Dallas, Texas. The case received national attention over the race of the two teens. Judge John Roach Jr. oversaw the trial and did a media interview shortly after the verdict. Lee Merritt from Anthony's defense team says the interview violated judicial conduct rules.
The best thing for justice to get him out of the place and get a neutral judge in.
A hearing on a separate motion for a new trial is scheduled for Thursday. For NPR News, I'm Caroline Love in McKinney.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 379 points. The Nasdaq is down 190. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Procter & Gamble, maker of Rolaids, containing a dual-active formula with the goal of neutralizing acid in seconds for heartburn relief. Rolaids spells relief. Learn more at Rolaids.com.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. From a proposed utility solar project in Sullivan County to the latest news of the closure at the care center in Sunset Lake, some big changes could be coming to the Catskills. Radio Catskills' Kimberly Izar caught up with Congressmember Josh Riley, who represents the 19th Congressional District, about the most pressing issues in the area. The 19th District is the second largest congressional district in the state, spanning from the Finger Lakes into the Hudson Valley regions, including Sullivan, Delaware, and parts of Ulster counties.
I wanted to start with really the latest breaking news that we found out this morning coming out of Sullivan County. The county and New York State Department of Health have announced that they will be closing the care center at Sunset Lake, which is in Liberty, citing financial challenges and inability to transfer their operations to its consulting firm. Would love to just start by hearing your initial reactions to the news.
Yeah, well, it's obviously devastating news for the community, and my office is in touch with local leaders on the ground to help with next steps. But I think the details of this are really important, but it's also important to put it in a broader context of what we see happening across this district and across our rural communities, which is the impact of Washington politicians who have their priorities completely backwards. I've visited so many nursing homes and senior care facilities, so many schools and childcare facilities, so many of our rural hospitals. And what I hear over and over is exactly these sorts of challenges where budgets are being stretched beyond the breaking point. We saw with, they call it the One Big Beautiful Bill, H.R. 1, last year, a $1 trillion cut from the public health system and from nutrition assistance and from the safety net that so many of our neighbors depend on and have earned, frankly. All of those cuts were done to provide trillions of dollars in tax breaks to the top 1%, the biggest corporations, folks who really don't need it right now. In addition to that, it added $3 trillion to the debt, which my kids and the next generation are going to pay. So all of this is the consequence of a politics that has its priorities completely backwards. We should be investing in our rural communities. We should be investing in folks across upstate New York, making sure people have, you know, a place, a safe, affordable, reliable place for their kids' care, for their parents' care, and everything in between. And instead, what we've seen from Washington politicians who control the House, control the Senate, control the White House right now are cuts that lead to these really, really difficult budgetary situations.
And, you know, as our population gets older, would love to just hear a little bit about what legislation is kind of being discussed. Is there any legislation in the works to make senior care both affordable and more accessible in these rural communities?
Yeah, one of the things that I've been working on, and it's with respect to the healthcare system generally, but particularly on these issues, and especially in our rural communities, and especially when it comes to our seniors. Right now, so much money in the healthcare system is just going to corporate profits instead of to the care people need, people deserve, people have earned. I've introduced bipartisan legislation, which will make sure that the money folks are shelling out for their premiums and for their insurance is actually going to their care and is actually going into the health system to pay the providers and to make sure care is available. Healthcare should be a civil right. It shouldn't be something that is driving families into bankruptcy. And that goes for taking care of your kids, taking care of your parents, taking care of yourself.
Shifting gears a bit, but staying in Sullivan County, I know that you were in Bethel this past weekend chatting with residents in the town about the Toronto Reservoir. This reservoir has been unusable for recreational use, and the timeline to fix that, the drawdown has been extended, I believe, to 2030. That's according to reporting from the River Reporter. Talk to me a little bit about what you heard from residents about exactly why this is happening and how it's affecting them.
Yeah, it's a huge amount of frustration, and rightfully so. This is just another example of a bureaucratic political red tape and corporate indifference hurting our communities across upstate New York. This is a reservoir that it provides recreational opportunities for families. I talked to a bunch of folks from the Iroquois Sportsman Club. It's a recreational opportunities, but it's really a lot more than that. There's a major public safety issue here because the fire department and the first responders I spoke with, they're very worried about their ability to respond to fires with the water levels at their where they are currently. It's a major issue for the tax base in the town. I mean, Sullivan County, a lot of communities have really been struggling. And the last thing we need is for some big corporation and a bunch of bureaucrats to put us in a situation that the tax base is getting eroded. And one of the pieces of it that just, you know, really stuck with me, I heard from a number of folks, grandparents, who had enjoyed that lake and that community during their own childhoods. And they wanted nothing else than to be able to share that with their grandkids as well. And they can't do that now because the water levels are so low. And so it was really helpful for me to hear directly from the community to see for myself what the situation is. I am going to be in touch with the leadership at Apollo, which is the big corporation, multi-billion-dollar corporation that now owns the reservoir. And I'll be in touch with the federal agency, FERC, which is in charge there, and tell them enough is enough. Stop kicking the can down the road. This community deserves this issue to be addressed, and it needs to be addressed now.
And for folks who might not be super familiar with this issue, who exactly has the authority to essentially repair and the reservoir?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. There's a whole lot of finger pointing going on. And so it sort of depends who you ask. And so what I'm going to do is bring together all the folks who are pointing fingers at each other in one place and tell them they've got to figure it out. It's generally FERC, which is a federal agency, and Apollo, which is the major asset management corporation that owns it. They need to get on the same page, come up with a plan, and do what needs to be done to raise these water levels. There's a question here, not to get too much into the details on this, but there's actually sort of a threshold question here of whether the reservoir even needs repairs at all. There's a real question of you know, whether work actually even has to be done. And so these folks need to figure it out now and do something about it, because the last thing they can afford to happen is a fire or a public emergency where the water to deal with it is not available because of their neglect and their bureaucratic red tape. So we're going to press Apollo, press FERC on this, and hopefully get some answers.
And as you kind of work with these various different parties at play, is there anything that, you know, Bethel residents should know kind of in the meantime?
I think the most important thing is I hear them, that we had, I don't know how many people turned out. It was well over 100. And so having them share their stories is probably the single most important thing. Having those stories to go and press the regulators and press this massive corporation to fix this is really valuable. So continue to reach out to my office, continue to share my stories. There's a gentleman who I met with last week, and he was there, and he said, I'm here to speak on behalf of his mom, who was also there with him, and told me this story about how the reservoir meant so much to their family over the generations, and it broke their heart. It was heartbreaking to me to hear that now the grandkids are going to other places because there's no water in the reservoir. And these are years that this grandma had worked her whole life for to spend with her kids in this community. And she's being denied that opportunity because of a bunch of bureaucratic red tape and corporate indifference. It's not acceptable.
Another issue that residents in the Catskills, especially that we've been hearing about, is proposed utility solar. There has been a proposed project by the developer RWE called the Town Line Solar Project. It encompasses about 1,200 acres that would essentially border between the towns of Forestburg and Thompson. If it's built, it would be the largest solar project in the Catskills and then also in the Hudson Valley. And the developer has, they have submitted their application to ORES, the state agency kind of tasked with managing and approving these siting permits. Would love to just hear kind of what your take is on the project.
Yeah, so this project, and there are a number of others across this district. So two things can be true. Number one, we need more energy on the grid, renewable energy on the grid to bring down utility prices. At the same time, we cannot be in a situation where a bunch of bureaucrats in Albany are overriding local communities. So the most important thing here is the views of the local community who are impacted by this project. One example of this up in Copaic in Columbia County, the town came together and passed, I don't know, it was 12, 18, 17 ordinances to stop a massive industrial solar project from coming in, taking over prime farmland, compromising the rural character of the community. And ORES was threatening to simply override that and plow forward with that project. We should not be shoving these projects down the throats of rural communities that don't want them. And so that is that should be the first and foremost consideration here is what do folks in the community want? What I have heard is a significant amount of opposition to this for environmental reasons and for other reasons. And we need to provide local control to these communities. We shouldn't have a bunch of bureaucrats in Albany forcing policies on these folks.
Yeah. And as you described, like, this is not the only utility solar project that is being proposed or even being approved in New York State. How do you actually balance those two truths, right? That there are valid residential concerns related to large scale solar project, concerns about risking the rural character of an area, while also the need for the state to meet its decarbonization goals, which were already significantly weakened in the state budget. Like, how do you actually balance those two concerns?
Yeah, well, a couple of things. One, I'm sick and tired of politicians from New York City pushing mandates on rural upstate New York without adequate consideration of the concerns and the needs of our community and what makes our community so special. So with respect to these solar projects, one of the questions I've had that I have not gotten a good answer to is, why are you not first looking to parking lots and the tops of city buildings or old industrial sites for these projects, and instead just assuming you can steamroll into rural upstate New York and take our prime farmland, which is the heart and soul of our community? So I'm not convinced that there's not a better way to do this, whether it's, you know, like I said, parking lots or industrial sites. But the other piece of this too, we have seen the Trump administration shell out billions and billions of dollars to cancel offshore wind projects, which would have created tons of really good construction jobs, would have generated a lot of energy to put onto the grid. And he's canceling all those projects, shelling out billions of dollars of taxpayer money to do it. And the reason he's doing it is because the oil and gas industry has this administration in their pocket, and they don't want to compete with those renewables. So there's certainly ways to do this. I certainly support renewables, but it has to be done in a responsible way, and it has to be done in a way that doesn't hurt rural communities across upstate New York.
I think that's something that we're hearing concerns from all angles, both the environmental concerns, as well as like concerns and criticism that concerns that people have with prime farmland could potentially be overstated. I want to shift gears a little bit and wanting to talk a little bit about the Farm Bill, which is the federal legislation that sets national agriculture policy for our listeners. Would love to just hear a little bit about what the latest is in terms of conversations in Washington about this, because I know that here in our region, that is definitely something that people are looking to.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really proud to have been the only Democrat in the New York delegation to vote for the Farm Bill. Not only that, I helped write a lot of it. All of the provisions that I wrote were rooted in stories that I heard directly from folks across this district, including, for example, just the other day, I was up at the Otsego County Fair, and I talked to a gentleman who bought his dairy farm in the 1980s, and he was telling me the milk prices haven't been adjusted the right way since then, decades ago. I have a bipartisan bill that got included in the Farm Bill to fix the milk pricing formula. Talked to a lot of folks, the costs, the input costs are just so high in operating our family farms. And so I worked on a bipartisan bill to update irrigation systems, bring down costs for farmers, and while doing it, create a bunch of really good manufacturing jobs here in upstate New York, building these efficient irrigation systems. One of the things I'm actually most proud of that I included in the Farm Bill, one of the leading causes of death and serious injuries on our farms across upstate New York, it's hilly here, are tractor rollovers. And a lot of people don't appreciate that a lot of tractors don't have roll bar protection on them. So I have a bipartisan bill that will retrofit tractors to make them more safe. And what's really special about this is that retrofitting program is actually run out of Bassett in Cooperstown in our district. And so this is really, for me, this was really about putting upstate first, putting upstate agriculture first, having hyper-local projects included in this big national piece of legislation. So the latest on it is that it looks like it has stalled in the Senate. There is a the main debate right now is trying to get a delay of some of the cuts to SNAP benefits. I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get that. But this is a piece of legislation that our ag community across upstate New York deserves. They need it. And I'm going to continue to fight for it. And you know, this is an example where I've broken with my own party to do right by upstate New York. Democratic Party bosses and leaders in Washington pushed all the Democrats, whipped all the Democrats to vote against this bill. I voted for it because I work for folks in upstate New York and not party bosses in Washington.
I'm curious to hear what you're hearing from maybe some of the smaller farmers. Some of the criticism that we hear about the bill is that, you know, it's tailored to larger agriculture producers. Are you hearing similar concerns, and kind of how are you bringing that feedback back to Washington?
I haven't been, because the bills that I introduced that got included in this Farm Bill are specifically tailored to the needs of particular farms across this district. So I'll give you just one example of this. We just had over the spring, the frost wiped out a whole bunch of our specialty crops, apples, and talked to a bunch of folks across the region who lost a lot of their crops. And one of the big problems is the big commodity crops actually have a insurance program that is pretty robust and it's predictable, whereas our small specialty crop growers across upstate New York don't have that. And so one of the things I got included in the Farm Bill, again, on a bipartisan basis, is disaster assistance that folks can count on so that we're not, every time there's a frost or disaster, trying to chase relief. We were able to get that disaster declaration for this last spring, but we shouldn't be dealing with that stuff for our small growers. After the fact, they should be able to count on it. I'll give you just like one other example on this. There's about 450 dairies across this district, 4,500 farms, and one of the biggest challenges our dairy farmers are facing is access to market. So I was really proud to be one of the Democrats to help get whole milk back into our schools. President Trump signed that. And I also have a bipartisan provision in the Farm Bill that would add yogurt to the Dairy Nutrition Incentive Program, which allows folks who are on SNAP to stretch those dollars by purchasing yogurt made here in upstate New York at Chobani, using the milk that's produced by dairy farmers all across upstate New York. And so from my perspective, my approach to the Farm Bill was get as much input from as many farmers as possible across this district and make sure I'm addressing their needs in a bipartisan way in this bill. Last thing I'll say on this, I do think, you know, the criticism is right, though, generally with how farm policy has been set in this country for a long time. It's the biggest corporations, the biggest ag monopolies. You know, you think of these corporations like, I don't know, ConAgra and these other ones, these massive monopolies that give a bunch of corporate PAC money to the politicians and then send their lobbyists in to do their bidding. When I asked to get onto the Agriculture Committee, I did that rejecting all corporate PAC money and making clear I am here to fight for small family farmers across upstate New York, and I'll fight against anybody, whether it's the big corporations or my own party, to do it.
I'm realizing we're quickly coming up on time, and I did want to look a little bit ahead. Election Day is very quickly approaching, which feels wild.
Can you believe it?
I can't believe it.
Yeah, it really does.
Can
you believe it?
I really can.
Yeah.
November 3rd, early voting kicking off in late October. You know, State Senator Peter Oberacher is running on the Republican ticket for the 19th congressional seat. Curious to hear just what are some of the top priorities going into Election Day, and can voters expect an upcoming debate anytime soon?
Yeah. So on the second question first, yes, we are currently reviewing invitations for debates. I think we just accepted one, or we're about to accept one, and then I believe there are others in the works as well. So yes, there will be a debate, and I'm really looking forward to it because there's a real contrast between my record and my opponent's on the issues that matter the most for folks. I've prioritized cutting taxes for the middle class and for seniors. I have a bill that would end permanently the tax on Social Security benefits. My opponent actually introduced, he hasn't passed a lot of legislation in Albany, but some of the legislation that he's passed are two bills to significantly raise taxes in Otsego and Shenango counties, two counties that really can't afford that. I've been fighting the utility companies tooth and nail. I don't take any corporate PAC money from them, and so they can't buy me off. So I've been fighting them to ban foreign corporations from owning our utility companies. I've actually taken them to court to stop the rate hikes. I've been fighting them so hard that one of them has actually threatened to sue me. My opponent, on the other hand, he took a whole bunch of corporate PAC money from the utility industry while they were raising rates on folks, and they got their money's worth. He went off to Albany and he voted four times to help them raise rates. Folks can't afford that. And so I'm looking forward to the debate. I love just being out in the community and talking to folks, regardless of political party, Democrats, Republicans, Independents. Everybody has a home here in this campaign. And so I'm looking forward to these next 10 weeks.
We've been chatting with Congressman Josh Riley, who represents the 19th Congressional District in New York. Representative, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. I always enjoy it.
Coming up, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro is taking action to regulate data center development, but some residents say the new rules don't go far enough. What the governor's executive order could mean for future data center projects in the Commonwealth. That's coming up after the break. It's Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Sullivan 180. building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at Sullivan180.org and from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
News comes fast, and it doesn't take weekends off. But we can slow it down a little, take a moment to think, look behind the headlines, and even have some time left over for surprises and a little fun. Join us on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Sunday mornings at 8 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On Tuesday, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro signed an executive order that would force data center developers to comply with the new planning and operating standards he unveiled in May. It's intended to force center developers to go through the State Department of Environmental Protection to get projects approved. When announcing his order, Shapiro highlighted the struggles of residents fighting a proposed data center and data centers in Archbald, Pennsylvania, Northeast PA. But WVIA environmental reporter Kat Bolas tells Radio Catskill those residents are skeptical of the governor's action, and some say they would prefer a moratorium. Radio Catskill's Jason Dole spoke with Kat Bolas last night on the Local Edition.
Kat, welcome back to Radio Catskill.
Hi, thank you again for having me. I always enjoy my conversations with Radio Catskill.
That's great. And we really appreciate you talking to us, you know, especially at times like this. Before we actually talk about what this executive order means, can we talk about his journey to this point? You know, back in February, we aired his big speech rolling out the budget and his agenda for the year live here on Radio Catskill. And he was talking about data centers back then.
So during his budget address, one of the things that he announced were his grid standards. So grid stands for Governor's Responsible Infrastructure Development, and they are specific standards that have to do with the data center industry. And there's four kind of key areas within grid standards that are kind of meant to protect Pennsylvanians and Pennsylvania.
What I feel like I've been watching in the Shapiro administration is that he has not wanted to say no to this industry, that he sees it as an industry that could help Pennsylvania, at least with finances. But he has been talking since February about his concerns. Is that an accurate way to look at this?
So, you know, the governor has been really focused on making Pennsylvania, competitive nationwide as a place that is welcoming to business and welcoming to kind of bigger corporations, but also, you know, he does a lot of work with small businesses and community businesses too. You know, that's kind of been one of the focus points of his administration, is kind of building up, you know, this business community, small and large within Pennsylvania, and making the state kind of attractive to bring in, you know, bigger industry that then could provide jobs for Pennsylvanians. Jobs that pay, you know, family sustaining wages. So I think, you know, if we really want to go back, in June 2025, Shapiro was in Columbia County, which is kind of like north central Pennsylvania. We have a nuclear power plant there, the Susquehanna Steam Electric Station, and he made an announcement that Amazon would invest $22 billion into building data centers in Pennsylvania, one of them being next to the Susquehanna Steam Electric Station. So I think like 14 of those buildings are complete, and I'm not sure what the total is going to be there. So I think, you know, and then kind of from June on, like if we're talking June to February, you know, all of these developers came in and just started proposing plans in small communities to build these like massive data centers that residents worry will use a ton of power and electricity and change their quality of life. So then we head back to February, where he kind of announced these grid standards. In May, he finalized the standards. And then at the end of June, the Pennsylvania House passed a bill to codify grid into law, but the Senate has yet to pass it, which is kind of what led us to the executive order yesterday.
So he's signing an executive order before this can pass in the Senate. It basically, is that an acknowledgement of how quickly things are moving?
I mean, he said during, Shapiro made a speech yesterday before he signed the executive order, and he said that the Senate's inaction kind of left him with no other option than the executive order. He mentioned that there's a lot of predatory developers and bad proposals that are kind of inundating our communities in Pennsylvania, especially kind of our small townships and boroughs and our just smaller municipalities that are now forced to zone for an industry that they may not have heard of until maybe 6 months ago to a year. So I think that's kind of where all this comes from. I mean, it's been a community uprising, and I don't use uprising in a negative way at all. I've been reporting in Northeast Pennsylvania for almost 15 years at this point, and it's kind of the issue that I've seen people the most united, the most educated, and kind of the most worried about. And when you have that happening across the state, because it isn't just Northeast and North Central Pennsylvania, these data center proposals are happening down near Philadelphia and out near Pittsburgh and kind of in our more rural areas too, especially with, the access to kind of large swaths of farmland. At some point it makes it to the governor's office.
Yeah. Governor yesterday saying, quote, "We will not be bullied by developers and bulldozed by the lawyers working for these big tech companies. We have a long history in Pennsylvania of industry running roughshod over our communities to make a buck. That stops with me." So, end quote there from Governor Josh Shapiro in the statement. We've been talking to you right along about the data center development in Archbald, Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. north of the Scranton metropolitan area there. And the governor actually mentioned Archbald in his statement yesterday.
Yeah, so he visited Archbald in late May. It was somewhat of a surprise visit. He met with a very small group of Archbald residents, actually in neighboring Blakely at State Representative Kyle Mullen's office. He was there probably for about an hour or two. But before he met with the residents, he visited Ed Staback Park, which is kind of this very beautiful park that's really kind of in the middle of Archbald, and there's a developer who wants to build data centers kind of surrounding this park, and then there's another developer who wants to build like a power plant next to the park. So, the governor said, he stood in one of the baseball fields and he thought about, if his kids were playing sports there and if there was this data center humming in the background. And then he listened to residents kind of talk about what they're dealing with, because in Archibald, there's no end users. No one knows who's going to operate these data centers that are coming in. The developers are all, well, not all, the developers are mostly from out of town. They submit these plans. I always like to say the borough's about the size of Manhattan and New York City, and they want to build 51 data centers, the size of Walmart there. And this is a small, it's a river valley town. There's mountains on either side. It's beautiful in the fall when the fall foliage changes. And if there were to be six data centers with kind of a seventh proposal kind of lurking on the horizon, it would fundamentally change the borough. And so he went there and he listened to residents, and they're kind of lukewarm on the visit, but he mentioned in his speech yesterday that was one of the reasons for kind of forcing his hand on this executive order, especially because the developers there, there's no Amazon that we know of, or Meta, or any of these big tech companies. It's just kind of like developers from out of state with out of state lawyers coming in.
Mm-hmm. And you say he got a lukewarm reception in Archbold in May, but now that he's now that he's made this executive order, he's actually taking some action here. How are they feeling about him now?
Still kind of lukewarm. You know, in Archbold, one of the groups that popped up is the Stop Archbold Data Centers group, and they've kind of they've gone statewide, they've gone nationwide. People kind of look to them as a source for how you could kind of work to fight and regulate the data center industry within a small community. And I spoke with one of the co-founders, Tammy Misevich Healy, and she's upset. You know, she wishes that the governor would just pass a moratorium or would sign a moratorium, you know, into, you know, through an executive order. They want a full stop on data center development because they believe that the communities just need time to catch up with this gold rush, you know, of a development that's kind of inundating Northeast and North Central Pennsylvania. And then another group I spoke with is the Concerned Citizens of Montour County. And that group has worked through the Right to Know law to kind of, you know, research like what went into the developing these grid proposals. And the one thing that they found out was that the governor's office had reached out to Amazon and had reached out to the Data Center Coalition, which is a nationwide kind of organization for the industry to talk about, you know, to get their opinion on grid. But I did have the governor's office, you know, tell me we did also reach out to environmental organizations. You know, we kind of we reached out to everyone to put these grids to come up with these grid standards. So, I mean, at the end of the day, they're skeptical of the grid standards and the executive order. And they really just want a moratorium, you know, like which was passed in New York State, our neighbor.
Yeah, yes, they're looking at that example. Again, you mentioned Miskiewicz Healy, and you quote her as saying, quote, "We want a moratorium," and I'm not sure how many times we could say that. And if he's interested in why, we can explain that in very, you know, thorough detail, end quote. So that's a reaction from the folks on the ground potentially being impacted by this type of development, and that's their reaction to this executive order. What about the reaction of lawmakers in Harrisburg?
You know, it was interesting, you know, some lawmakers, you know, were on board with it. You know, the state Senate Democratic leader, Jay Costa, you know, he credited the governor for, you know, quote, stepping up and demonstrating real common sense leadership as Senate Republicans fail to engage in this critical conversation. You know, they seem to be blaming the Senate Republicans for you know, not voting on grid standards. But there are, you know, a lot of Senate Republicans that are, or even just state elected Republicans that are, you know, opposed to this, industry. State Senator Rosemary Brown, her district includes Archbold. She wants a moratorium. There's a state representative down in Luzerne County, Jamie Walsh. He's very anti, you know, data center. So it's kind of becoming a political issue from the local to the state in Pennsylvania.
Now that this executive order has been signed, what will you be looking for next as you continue to cover this issue?
Yeah, so I'm really interested in how this is going to impact the current proposals in play. One of the things with the grid standards is, you know, you're not going to get DEP permits if you don't sign on to the grid standards. And any big development, and DEP is the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, and any big, you know, project, any big massive industrial construction project needs some sort of DEP permit. So I'm interested to see how that changes things, if we're going to start seeing kind of these more like on the fringe proposals maybe back out of their commitment. But I also think that this is going to end up going to the courts, which is where I feel like a lot of these data center proposals are going to end up regardless. I think a lot of them are going to end up being decided by judges in courtrooms. And I think this executive order might find its way there as well. So we will definitely be following up on that.
Well, Kat Bolus, I thank you so much for being on top of the story and taking the time once again to break it down for our listeners here on Radio Catskill. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Anytime.
There's more on Kat's data center reporting in Northeast Pennsylvania at WVIA.org. And in Wayne County, the Clinton Township Joint Supervisors and Planning Commission public hearing on the proposed data center by the Linde Corporation is Saturday, August 22nd at 10 a.m. at the Wayne County Park Street Complex. That's at 648 West Park Street in Honesdale. Coming up, the Lackawack Sanctuary looking to fall already for some popular run-walk events. We'll learn more. This is Radio Chatskill.
Traveling people pass songs and tunes down the generations more than any other group. Next time on the Bugle of the Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, we'll hear British and Irish songs and tunes from and about travellers. Join me, if you'd be so kind, on Sunday afternoon at 3.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. Lackawack Sanctuary has long brought together outdoor recreation, environmental education, and community wellness. This fall, they're inviting folks of all ages to get outside and explore the preserve through a series of popular run-walk events. Joining us now is Craig Lukacs from Lackawack to talk about how these events promote well-being and help people connect with the unique natural preserve that is Lackawack Sanctuary. Craig, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And I know we're looking ahead to fall a little bit, but it's coming soon. Before we get to those events in October and November, tell folks a little bit more about Lackawack Sanctuary, where you're located, and what makes it so unique in the region.
So we're located, obviously, in the southern Wayne County of northeastern Pennsylvania, along the shoreline of Lake Wampanoag. And what makes us really unique is our mission of research, education, and preservation. Research on the environment around the area, water quality, and terrestrial work in forests. We do education programs for not only the public, but K-12 students, and also summer camps. And then preservation, we have several sanctuaries throughout the area, and also preserving historical buildings at our main sanctuary in Wayne County.
And the research, education, conservation part of this is something that's really important and maybe is sort of in the background for some folks who maybe just be out there enjoying the nature of the area, because you do offer these other events for folks to explore it. Talk about how those things all come together in your work.
Yeah, sure. So we've been doing scientific research since 1966 when we were founded. And we've been doing a lot more push to teach the public about what we do in terms of environmental work and our research. And we've launched some programs where we work with lake communities and help them monitor their lakes for water quality. So that's kind of an offshoot. But we try to tie in our science to not only our field trips, so we kind of have an upper hand with our field trips, because like other nature centers, to just, you know, work with the general nature around their spaces, we tie in the science to those field trips, such as water quality. So students like take samples, and then we'll analyze those samples and then tie it back to, well, why is water quality important for, you know, the general public, for drinking water, for fishing and boating and swimming and that kind of stuff. So we try to do that way, but we also do it when we have public people come visiting Lackawack. We have banners up about what our scientists are studying, so they can learn a little bit more about, like, that connection between, you may not see the scientist on property or in the lab, but you definitely can learn a little bit about what they're studying here and why these properties are so important.
And what do the scientists do with that information? Where do they take it back? If they're students, I'm assuming they're taking it back to their schools. But mm-hmm. Does Lackawack then push this information out into other areas as well?
Yeah, so one of the challenges for us is to how do we disseminate what we're finding in terms of research. So obviously we have to, in a sense, simplify it a little bit, because the terminology that scientists use is a little bit different. But we've been trying to offer more programs where we do disseminate the information. For example, we do have a researcher who does work on snakes, and have him come in and do presentations for the public about snakes. So he's basically taking what he's studying and then talking to the public about what he's learned. So that's kind of one way that we tie back into just the general public learning about our research. And we also do it by publishing things on our socials. And, you know, people can always, we always talk to people when they come in to visit a lab, or if they ask us about, like, well, what's the lab for? And so there's a lot of outreach about trying to connect those two together.
And one of the ways that folks are able to encounter is the stuff that you do there is the popular run walk events that we mentioned. Talk about those that are coming up.
Sure. So this year is our 13th annual Lake to Lake. It's a 8K trail run, woods walk, and also a dog wag. So people love to bring their dogs. And we welcome dogs, obviously, to our property all the time. But that is Sunday, October 18th this year. And like I said, it's the 13th annual. It's probably something that we've been doing for a long time since I started here, and brings out all different types of people, people that have never been to Lackawacken. So if you're further away, you know, plan to make a day trip out of it. Come for a run, for a walk, and then, you know, spend some time around Lake Wampompak. But it goes to support our education programs as well. And then we started a new run in November. I'm just mentioning that it's a veteran run. So it's around Veterans Day, and that helps support our veterans programs. And we actually host that race in Pike County. It's along the Lackawaxen, because we have also a sanctuary over there, but we can't run into our sanctuary. So we do it in one of the township parks over there, but that's in November as well. So it's two ways to support what we do in terms of not only our education, but also working with different types of populations like veterans.
Save the date or dates. That's Craig Lukacs, president of Lackawack Sanctuary. More information about all of their work in these events at lackawack.org. That's lackawac.org. Craig, thanks again.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Quick break for us, and we'll be back with more Radio Chatskill after this.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
It's Radio Chatskill. Kendra Payne's road to opening her Sullivan County tea shop was winding. After years of working in health and wellness, she opened her first brick-and-mortar store 5 years ago. As the nation marks Black Business Month, the New York Public News Network's Ilya Sguerra visited the store to learn more about Payne's journey.
A cafe sign listing teas and lattes welcomes customers visiting the Herbal Scoop. Then the wall is filled with even more tea options, from black to milky oolongs, as well as tulsi, ashwagandha, marshmallow root, and yerba mate. The Narrowsburg shop was founded by Kendra Payne. She says she's been a tea lover for many years. Her vitamin tea blend is one of her favorites at the moment. And she opens a container of it to show me.
That smells wonderful.
Yeah.
It smells like minty and
yeah, there's like a little bit of spearmint in here. There's some oat straw and lemongrass. There's lots of good herbs. You can kind of see the like red clover flowers coming through. It's a really light and bright tea, mellow. You can really mix it with, like, if you wanted to like have some sort of like a loaded water for like electrolytes, adding in some berries, maybe a little bit of honey.
For years, Payne worked in the wellness field, often as a fitness or yoga instructor. All the while, her love of tea lurked in the background.
In like my yoga teaching and having clients, people were always asking me, like, what are you drinking? Why does your skin look so good? Why aren't you ever sick? You know? And I was like, oh, this is like my ginger turmeric tea, or this is my chamomile, or whatever I was drinking at that time. And people were like, well, share me the recipe. Like, I want to do what you're doing.
She says she's been dabbling with herbalism since 2005 and went to school to formally study it in 2012. Finally, she opened her first brick-and-mortar store in 2021 in Calicoon, one town over from where she is now. In addition to selling a variety of drinks, Payne also grows about one-third of her herbs on her farm nearby. I asked her about some of the challenges of running a business in rural New York as a Black woman. She says it's an honor, especially since Black-owned businesses often have an uphill battle.
Historically, our businesses have been, you know, underfunded. It takes a long time to build trust, and that's just the way that it's been. And especially for Black women-owned businesses, it is very, very difficult, if ever, for our businesses to hit, you know, the first milestone, which we say in small businesses is like $100,000. It is like less than 1% of women-owned businesses are able to hit that, and not because they don't have the product or not because it's, you know, priced right, but just because we don't have the financing and the opportunities. When we go in to ask, whether it's bank or venture capital or whatever is going on, we are getting turned down more times than any other demographic, and that's really hard to deal with.
According to an analysis by LendingTree, in 2024, the denial rate to lines of credit or cash advances for Black businesses with 1 to 4 employees was twice as high as white businesses. According to New York State Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli, Black businesses make up only 3.5% of all small business owners in the state, even though New York's population is more than 14% Black. Payne says she'd like to see some of the barriers come down.
I would like for it to be easier for us to open our doors. It is quite a feat as a Black-owned business to get support, to get financial support. I would just like for it to be all a lot easier. I would like the trust building, the community building. You know, if we make a mistake, let it not be at the detriment of our business, but to let us be able to learn and for our communities to be able to forgive us. I would like for us to have access to capital and mentorships. There's just a lot of stuff that's really hard, and there's a lot of barriers around as a Black-owned business, and especially as a Black woman-owned businesses, that we just don't get. And those doors need to be open to us just as much as anyone else.
Payne is driven by her love for the products she sells. She says it's important for her to keep herbalism accessible, which is why she loves tea so much. Besides the vitamin T, she says it's tough to pick some of her other favorite blends.
And can you talk me through some of your favorite blends that you have created yourself and, you know, what went into those?
Oh, that's really difficult. Oh, it's really difficult. Okay. I would probably say, I'm sorry to all my other teas. Oh.
She picks one called Holy Chai, filled with tulsi, cardamom, cinnamon, ginger, orange peel, and cloves. Then she opens a jar of bright red hibiscus, and the smell fills the air.
It does really well as both a hot or iced tea, and like it's delicious on its own, but also has a ton of benefits, tons of antioxidants. It's really heart supportive, and so, you know, you think you're getting a delicious cup of tea, which you are, but it also has tons of benefits, and I love being able to bring herbs like that forward so that it's easy for people to start an herbal ritual and not have to like choke something down that's really disgusting. Like, you can get there in your herbal journey, but if you're first starting out, you might want something like hibiscus to be able to, you know, support your wellness goals.
Apart from her shop on Main Street in Narrowsburg, Payne also has a pop-up stand in Beacon every other Sunday and at the Berryville Farmers Market until October. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Elias Guerra.
And that's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder to sign up for our free weekly newsletter. If you haven't done so, you can sign up today and get it in your inbox tomorrow. It comes out every Friday. It's free and helps you stay connected and informed with the latest local news, culture, and more in your inbox every Friday. Just go to wjffradio.org and subscribe now. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills. From inpatient and outpatient care to primary, urgent, and specialty care with Garnet Health doctors in Sullivan County. Exceptional lives here. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
On this Old House Radio Hour, don't get eaten alive. The miracle trick that kills mosquitoes without toxic sprays or chemicals.
My approach to gardening is opening up more environment for native insects.
Plus, CNN anchor Casey Hunt takes you inside her landmark mid-century home. That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour. Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
Today's weather, mostly cloudy, followed by a little rain this afternoon. High 74 with some occasional rain this evening. Otherwise, clouds breaking tonight, low 56. For Friday, mostly sunny and pleasant with a high of 78. But Saturday, clouds and sun, not as warm, and we might see some heavy thunderstorms Saturday evening through Sunday afternoon. Sunday's high 73. On Point is coming up next from WBUR in Boston. It's 11 o'clock.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming online at wjffradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.